The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. Today I'm focusing on the origins and background to World War II, the most destructive conflict in history. A sober and informed understanding of this terrible global clash is important, not least because the lessons we draw from an understanding of the war are important in how we view crucial political, social, and cultural issues today. Educators and public figures often claim to draw meaningful lessons from the Second World War, and they cite these to support or justify diplomatic and military policies of great importance. But much of what we're told about World War II, especially by educators, the mass media, and politicians in today's America, is dangerously distorted, misrepresented, and falsified. Today I'm going to deal with some key aspects of the origins of the war. In doing so, I'm responding to requests from listeners to these broadcasts, input that I welcome and very much appreciate. What was Hitler's motive in ordering a German attack against Poland in 1939? What were his goals? Did he organize a phony false flag operation to provide a pretext for a German attack against Poland? Why did Britain and France respond by declaring war against Germany? Was World War II inevitable? A good starting point in looking at World War II is the important book by the great British historian A.J.P. Taylor. He's one of the most outstanding English historians of the 20th century. His book, The Origins of the Second World War, set off tremendous discussion, debate, and controversy when it first appeared in 1961. But it has held up very well over time, and there is increasingly, I think, a consensus among historians that Taylor's book is essentially correct. Even though what Taylor wrote and what historians increasingly agree upon is that the portrayal of Hitler and the origins of World War II from the Nuremberg trials of 1945-46 and the common mass media presentation of Hitler and his place in history and the origins of the war is essentially untrue. It's essentially a myth. Taylor begins in his book by showing that the claim that Hitler, after taking power, was set on building an enormous military machine is a lie. It's not true. It's a myth. When Hitler took power in Germany in 1933, the great issue was restoring prosperity and banishing unemployment. That was the great problem not only in Germany but throughout the Western world. At that time, Germany's military was much, much smaller than that of its neighbors. In fact, because of the Treaty of Versailles imposed upon Germany after World War I, Germany was not allowed to have an army larger than 100,000 men. But even more significantly, it was prohibited from having any military aircraft, any submarines, any large ships, no battleships, no destroyers. It was not allowed to have heavy artillery or any tanks. In fact, in 1933, Germany's military was substantially smaller, its military force much smaller than any of its neighbors, including even Czechoslovakia, had a much more formidable military force than Germany. The largest army in most of Europe at that time was the French army. It was far, far larger than that of Germany, which had conscription too, in fact, by the way. Very formidable also was the large Polish military at that time, and also looming over it was the tremendous military might of the Soviet Union and its Red Army. So, as A.J.P. Taylor points out, the often repeated claim that German recovery was caused by rearmament is not true. Up until the spring of 1936, rearmament was largely a myth. Hitler, in fact, did not apply any prepared economic plan, certainly with regard to the military. And Taylor cites in this regard an important book by the American historian Burton H. Klein, Germany's Economic Preparations for War, which I'll mention a little bit more later. Taylor goes on to write, German rearmament was largely a myth until the spring of 1936. Then Hitler put some reality into it. His motive was principally fear of the Red Army. And, of course, Great Britain and France had begun to rearm also. Hitler, in fact, raced along with others, and not much faster. Again, it's important to remember that Hitler was starting virtually from point zero. So the pace of rearmament in Germany, although it was somewhat faster than that of his neighbors, was starting from a very low point. As Taylor goes on, in October 1936, Hitler told Goering to prepare the German army and German economy for war within 4 years, but he laid down no detailed requirements. He wanted the German military to be ready for war within 4 years. Now, at this time, France, of course, had a military that was ready for war right then. Poland had a large military. In fact, it had been involved in war with the Soviet Union in the early 1920s. Now, Taylor goes on, when war broke out in 1939, Germany had 1,450 modern fighter planes and 800 bombers. Great Britain and France had 950 fighters, but 1,300 bombers, far more than Germany. The Germans had 3,500 tanks, but Great Britain and France had 3,850, that is more than Germany. In each case, as Taylor points out, Allied intelligence estimated German strength at more than twice the true figures. As usual, Hitler was thought to have planned and prepared for a great war. In fact, he had not. He goes on that German production of armaments was not reduced merely during the winter of 1940-41. Hitler reduced production of armaments even more in the autumn of 1941 when the war against Russia had already begun. No serious change took place after the initial setback in Russia, nor even after the catastrophe of Stalingrad. Germany remained with a peace-like war economy. He makes the point that Germany did not seriously build up a very large war economy until 1943 and 1944. Now, as I mentioned, Taylor cites the book, important book, by the American historian Burton H. Klein. Now, this is an important book entitled Germany's Economic Preparations for War. It was published by the Harvard University Press in 1959. And Burton Klein could hardly be less prestigious an economist in writing this book. He was born in Minneapolis. He received a PhD from Harvard. He worked with the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey along with the noted economist John Kenneth Galbraith. He was served as a special assistant to the U.S. Secretary of Defense from 1963 to 65. In 1967, he joined the teaching staff of the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, where he remained for years as a professor of economics. Now, his book, Germany's Economic Preparations for War, is not only authoritative, it's noteworthy because it's very often ignored. It's been widely read and cited by specialists, but the main points that are made by Klein in this book are largely ignored by the mass media and by educators and encyclopedias and so forth. Now, Here's what Klein writes in his book. In the pre-war period, that is up until 1939, the German economy produced both butter and guns. Much more of the former, that is, of peacetime goods, and much less of the latter than has been commonly assumed. By 1937, civilian consumption, investment in consumer goods industries, and the government non-war expenditures equal or exceeded previous peak levels. There is no question, therefore, of a rearmament program so large that it prevented a substantial recovery of civilian production. The volume of expenditures for rearmament was actually quite modest. In the period 1933 through 1938, rearmament expenditures absorbed less than 10% of Germany's gross national product, and even as late as 1938, only 15%. The volume of munitions production and the number of divisions which Germany mobilized was, by comparison with published appraisals, small. Investment in these industries comprising the war potential was not much larger than the volume reached in the prosperous years of the previous decade and was small in relation to total investment. The scale of German economic mobilization for war, Burton Klein writes, was quite modest. That's his words. He tries to deal with the question of why. Well, first of all, he says, the government was unwilling to increase public expenditures and incur larger deficits. Hitler wanted to avoid a larger deficit in the German government budget. And this was motivated by a fear of inflation, and, as Klein points out, was a major factor in explaining economic policy of pre-NS governments as well. The second reason was the unwillingness of the Germans to surrender a part of their prosperity level of consumption. The government's disinclination to ask for civilian sacrifices was demonstrated in a number of instances. And he mentions several cases of this. In other words, Germany under Hitler was hardly a militaristic society, certainly not like that of Soviet Union, and in many ways, much less than that of the United States today. There was a determination to keep the economy on an even keel and to ensure employment and prosperity for the German people. He goes on, Burton Klein goes on, the contrast between the conclusions reached in this summary, that is in this book, of Germany's economic preparations for war and those of earlier studies should be re-emphasized. When he says earlier studies, he means by popular writers who give the impression that Hitler was striving to build this huge war machine. That the National Socialists were undertaking massive preparations for war was the central assumption of practically all political and economic writings on NS Germany, writes Klein. Actually, Germany's rearmament was on a much smaller scale than was generally assumed, and it did not involve a large drain of resources from the civilian economy. Then he goes on that Germany's total output of munitions in the autumn of 1939, just before the outbreak of war, was not impressively larger than Britain's. What Germans excelled at was in improvising. The measures taken to get around the shortage of ferroalloys was truly ingenious, for example. The kinds of measures taken to restore production after bombing attacks during the war and the speed with which production was restored were remarkable. Again, and finally concluding from Klein, he writes, it is hardly surprising that Germany eventually lost the war to a combination of powers whose economic war potential vastly exceeded hers. What is much more surprising is how well she did despite the economic odds against her. Going back to the book by the British historian A.J.P. Taylor, he not only takes aim at the common view that the Hitler government was determined for war, but he goes on to puncture other soap bubble myths about Germany during this period of time. He points out, for example, that the popularity of the Hitler government was widespread, deep-rooted, and genuine. And in that regard, he cites the plebiscite that took place in the Saar region in western Germany in January 1935. This region had been detached from Germany in the aftermath of World War I and was under the control of the League of Nations. But on the basis of the treaty, a plebiscite was held in which the population voted 90% to return to Germany. It had the choice of either going to National Socialist Germany or to remain as a special district under the League of Nations or to go with France. Overwhelmingly, people voted in this plebiscite to join with Hitler's Germany, even though it was well known what life was like in Germany. In fact, that was the appeal, because there was prosperity and stability in Germany on a level far greater or better than in many other countries at that time. Now, German relations with Poland up until the beginning of 1939, that is from the time Hitler took power until January of 1939, were actually very good. In fact, shortly after taking power, Hitler moved quickly to make good relations with many of its neighbors, including eventually Italy, Hungary, and notably Poland. Now, at that time, Poland's leader was Józef Piłsudski, who was a staunch Polish nationalist and patriot, but a realistic man who understood that Poland's security required good relations with either Germany or Russia. Well, Poland had fought a war in 1920-21 against Soviet Russia, and relations with Germany were much more likely. Good relations were much more plausible than they were with the Soviet Union. And so shortly after Hitler took power, Piłsudski met with Joseph Goebbels. They were on good terms, and relations were good between those two countries. Hitler didn't want war with Poland. He wanted alliance with Poland. Now, Poland, in fact, and Germany had cooperated so much that in 1938, Poland had taken a portion of Czechoslovakia, which fell apart in that year, which was a ethnically Polish area called Teschen, and Poland was hardly any kind of democratic or liberal state in the sense that Americans or others like to talk about. It was a more or less authoritarian state, and it was had a policy pretty consistently anti-Jewish policy during those years. But in 1939, Hitler met with the Polish foreign minister and spoke again very well about the relations between Poland and Germany. But he added, the city of Danzig, which was on the Baltic and which had been taken away from Germany in the aftermath of World War I and put under the League of Nations, he said, is German and will always remain German and will sooner or later become part of Germany. He said that if the question of Danzig were settled, he would be ready to guarantee the corridor region to Poland. Up until that time, although relations were good with Poland, there was no final delineation of a border between Poland and Germany, and Hitler wanted to clear that up. He was asking for the return of Danzig to Germany. This was in accord with the principle of self-determination that the Allies, the United States, France, and Britain, and other countries had so ceremoniously proclaimed during World War I. He didn't think that this is something the Poles should have or would have any serious qualms about. But, nevertheless, the Poles refused to budge on this issue. This was motivated by a tremendous miscalculation and misunderstanding about the real relationship, the real power relationship between Poland and its neighbors. It was based on a tremendous inflated idea of Poland's military power and an underestimation of Germany's economic and potential military power. As Taylor writes, the Poles regarded themselves as an independent great power and forgot that they had gained their independence in 1918 only because both Russia and Germany had been defeated. Now they had to choose between Germany and Russia. They chose neither. Only Danzig prevented cooperation between Germany and Poland. Now, Taylor goes on that even in March 25th, 1925, he emphasized that he did not wish to solve the Danzig question by force. He believed that that would only drive Poland into the arms of Britain. As Taylor writes, Hitler's objective was alliance with Poland, not her destruction. The Danzig issue was a tiresome preliminary to be got out of the way. As before, Beck, the Polish foreign minister, kept it in the way. So long as Danzig stood between Poland and Germany, he, that is, Beck, could evade the embarrassing offer of a German alliance and so, as he thought, preserve Polish independence. Again, this is based on a miscalculation, a misunderstanding of the real power and strength of Poland. But then, this is as late as March 25, 1939. Now, at this time, Britain underwent a big change in its policy. It changed from a policy of more or less cooperation with Germany to one of staunch opposition to Germany. And this was laid out on March 30th, 1939, by the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, who then stated that if any action were taken by Germany or others that threatened the independence of Poland, and which the Polish government accordingly felt obliged to resist with national forces, the British and French governments would at once lend them all their support. Well, what this did, this had the effect of making the Polish government and Polish leadership stick by their refusal to make any compromise over the Danzig issue. But there was a level of deceit or misrepresentation in the British offer, because it was directed not against anyone who might threaten Polish independence, but against Germany alone. In fact, as Taylor writes, the German case over Danzig was stronger than it was over any other issue, even over the issue of Austria returning to Germany or going to Germany in 1938. Danzig had been a German city for centuries. As Taylor also writes, Danzig was the most justified of German grievances. A city of exclusively German population which manifestly wished to return to the Reich, and which Hitler himself restrained only with difficulty. The solution, too, seemed very easy. But again, it was the British guarantee of Poland which prevented and allowed the Poles to prevent any kind of peaceful settlement of this issue. It was, unfortunately, as Taylor points out, that Poles were willing to stake everything on this illusory, what he calls their illusory position as an independent great power. This was crucial, because very often wars come about not because in large measure, because of a miscalculation of the real situation. It was during this time, in August, that Hitler was meeting with League of Nations High Commissioner for Danzig, Jakob Burckhardt, and he said he emphasized his desire to settle this peacefully. And he said, "I want nothing from the West." And he made the point that what he was really concerned about was not Poland or Britain or France. He didn't want war with any of those countries. His great fear was the Soviet Union, the Red Army, which was, he believed, a threat to everyone. Now, Hitler laid out his proposal for a settlement, a peaceful settlement of this issue, in a big speech he gave, major speech, in April of 1938. But and it laid out the conditions for a return of Danzig to Germany. But this was after Britain had given the guarantee to Poland, and so Poland absolutely refused to agree to any kind of peaceful settlement. Well, we'll take a break at this point and return in a few minutes with the second half of this broadcast.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Greece's parliament has approved fresh cutbacks worth more than 3 billion euros. It includes lowering the minimum wage and cutting pensions, as well as reductions in health and education spending. Massive protests against the measure are expected in Greece on Wednesday. Athens had to push through the new austerity legislation before the country could receive any of the cash from its second bailout package worth 130 billion euros. And after tense and prolonged discussions, Greece's rescue was agreed by Eurozone ministers last week. And to talk more on what's ahead for the indebted country, we're now joined live by Peter Schiff, CEO at the investment company Euro Pacific Capital. Mr. Schiff, thank you very much indeed for your time. So Greece is clearing the last of the hurdles on its way to receiving the bailout cash. Aren't the cuts that have been introduced a necessary evil?
Well, they're not even evils. They're necessary. In fact, you talk about reducing the minimum wage. That's a good thing. In fact, it would be better if they abolished it completely. Wages obviously have to come down in Greece. They're too high. They're uncompetitive, particularly the wages for government workers, because the private sector can't afford these lavish pay packages. So, you know, you talk about austerity for who? Maybe for some of the government employees who have been living high on the hog, but it liberates the people, because the Greeks are going to have to pay. Those in the private sector are going to have to pay for those salaries. So these are positive reforms. They're steps in the right direction. Unfortunately, I don't think they're going far enough. I'd like to see more austerity.
Yeah, but a 22% reduction in the minimum wage is going to be really tough and painful for ordinary Greeks. But without the bailout, the country would have gone bankrupt in March.
The minimum wage law is keeping a lot of Greek people unemployed because they're not worth the minimum wage. And, of course, the alternative was not a reduction in the minimum wage, because if they had not agreed to this and they had left the Eurozone and gone to the drachma, Greek wages would still collapse. It's because they would have inflation. So instead of the minimum wage going down, they would wipe out the value of the wages that they were earning. So one way or another, Greeks were going to have to work for lower pay, particularly those that are employed by government. It's much better to earn a diminished quantity of euros than have a whole bunch of drachma that don't buy anything.
On Monday, Standard & Poor's gave Greece a rating of selective default, but the country has agreed a reduction of more than 50% of its debt to private creditors. Will this downgrade affect relations between Greece and the banks it owes money to?
I couldn't really hear you.
Okay, just let me repeat my question again. So we know that Standard & Poor's gave Greece a rating of selective default.
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Hello and welcome back. I'm talking about the origins of World War II and the outbreak of war in September 1939, first between Germany and Poland, and then the declarations of war by Britain and France 2 days after the German attack, which expanded the German-Polish conflict into a European-wide conflict. And I'm talking about the months leading up to the German attack, tensions built and the situation steadily deteriorated between Poland and Germany. During that time, the British ambassador to Berlin was Neville Henderson, a very astute diplomat, and he wrote to the Foreign Office in London. He says, history will judge the press generally to have been the principal cause of the war. Of all Germans, believe it or not, Hitler is the most moderate so far as Danzig and the corridor are concerned. He told Hitler quite truthfully, he said, the hostile attitude in Great Britain, he told Hitler, this is the British ambassador, was the work of Jews and enemies of the Nazis. When Henderson returned to Berlin, he wrote to another British official, I have held from the beginning that the Poles were utterly foolish and unwise. I personally no longer see any hope of avoiding war unless the Polish ambassador, that is Lipsky in Berlin, is instructed to apply today or at the latest tomorrow for a personal interview with Hitler. Now, Hitler was so eager to try to avoid a general war that the date for an attack against Poland had originally been set for August 25th, and this was postponed at the last minute, and the date was reset for the 1st of September. But Hitler's decision to attack Poland was based not just on the problems over the Danzig issue. It was also based upon the widespread and growing persecution of the German ethnic minority in the Polish Republic, many who had fled from Poland to Germany. There was widespread attacks against German civilians, confiscation of property of ethnic Germans, in general an increasingly chaotic situation, fortified and bolstered by an increasingly aggressive stance on the part of Poland. Now, it's hard to believe that Poles believed at that time that if it came to war, Poland would beat Germany, that the German military was largely a bluff, and the Polish military was much stronger. As A.J.P. Taylor points out, that he talks about a conversation of the Polish ambassador with a Swedish envoy, and the Polish ambassador said he would stake his reputation that German morale was breaking and that the present regime, the Hitler regime, would soon crack. The German offer of peace or a settlement of the Polish issue, Lipsky, the Polish ambassador, said, was a trap and a sign of weakness on the part of the Germans. It's hard to believe, but Poles and Polish leaders, many of them, actually believe that in the case of war, Polish troops would soon be in Berlin. It was on April 28, 1939, that Hitler first published the terms of a large-scale agreement with Poland. Again, this was part of a month-long process going back and forth with tremendous offers being made and discussion and an increasingly chaotic and worsening situation along the border and among the German minority population in Poland. The British ambassador, as I mentioned, Neville Henderson, again, responded to the efforts by Hitler and his government to settle the issue, writing in a letter to a close advisor to the British Prime Minister. He wrote, this is the British ambassador, I must admit that I regard Hitler's proposals as a fair basis of negotiation, and in my innermost heart I regard the Poles as exceedingly unwise to make enemies of Germany and as dangerous allies for us. The Prague coup, that is, in 1938, has affected our whole outlook towards Hitler, but it has not altered the merits of the Danzig Corridor case in themselves. I may be wrong, but I am personally convinced that there can be no permanent peace in Europe until Danzig has reverted to Germany. The Poles cannot be masters of 400,000 Germans in Danzig. Ergo, Germany must be. I am sorry I feel this way, but I fear that we are again on a bad wicket, as we were over the Sudeten, that is, the issue of the German minority in the former Czechoslovak Republic. Now, one of the most common claims made about the outbreak of war is that Hitler attacked on the basis of a pretext, a false flag operation, supposedly engineered to provide an excuse to attack Poland. This is widely repeated, and it first came to light at the Nuremberg trial of 1945-46. One American historian, actually a rather good historian generally, who I admire, Chalmers Johnson, repeats this in one of his books, and this is typical of many other American historians. He writes, "Perhaps the classic instance, that is, of a so-called false flag operation, was the German invasion of Poland on September 1, 1939. Germany claimed that it was avenging attacks by Polish soldiers who, it said, had seized a German radio station and broadcast hostile statements. After the war, it was revealed that the raiders were actually German SS troops dressed in Polish uniforms." That's the claim. And specifically, it's claimed that the Germans, dressed up as Poles, attacked a radio station in the Silesian town of Gliwice, Germans' radio station, broadcast some things, and then some people were killed, their bodies left there, but they were really concentration camp prisoners. Now, I've looked into this question in some detail. Was there really a pretext? Was this really the claim that Germany made at the time? Now, a pretext for war only makes sense if it's made public. If a pretext for war is to be have any use whatsoever, it has to be played up. If it's not played up, it's no good as a pretext. Well, in fact, I took the trouble to look at German newspapers from that period and to look at German public statements to see if, in fact, this Gliwice attack was really a pretext as claimed for an attack. Well, much to my amazement, there in the German press and also in the German official documents and papers that were issued, there was mention over and over of border violations, of attacks by Poles, including Polish soldiers, against Germans and against others. But the Gliwice incident, which supposedly is the pretext for an attack, is only one of a number of border violations that's cited, incidentally, in a long list of border violations from leading up to the German attack. In fact, the Gliwice incident, even if it took place, was nothing like a pretext for war. When German forces attacked on September 1st, Hitler issued a public statement to the German soldiers, to the armed forces. And here's what it said. "The Polish government, unwilling to establish good neighborly relations, which I have always sought, now wishes to force the issue between us by force of arms. The Germans in Poland are being persecuted with bloody terror and driven from their homes. Several cases of border violation, which cannot be tolerated by a great power, show that Poland is no longer prepared to respect the frontiers of the Reich. To put an end finally to these mad acts, I can see no other way from now on but to meet force with force and fire with fire." But the mistreatment of the German minority that Hitler alludes to was not an invention. It was based on reality. For example, in a secret memorandum in August 23, 1939, the German Ministry for Home Affairs reported that about 70,000 refugees belonging to the German ethnic minority in Poland had been given shelter in refugee clearing camps up to August 21. Of these, 45,000 came from Polish Upper Silesia and the old Olsa territory. This was a continuing problem that had been building up and was getting worse during this whole period of time. There was no need to cite Gliwice, the so-called Gliwice incident, as a pretext or the pretext for war. Now, more importantly than that, as I mentioned, the tension between Germany and Poland had been building steadily from the beginning of 1939 to September 1st, 1939. During this period of time, there was tremendous public discussion of all of the grievances that Germany had, of the border situation, and in the Polish press, of astonishingly arrogant statements about how Poland was going to beat Germany if it came to war, and refusal, absolute refusal by the Poles to make any kind of compromise over the issue of Danzig. It was during this period that the French premier, Edward Daladier, wrote a letter to Hitler about France's position with regard to this whole thing. And Hitler wrote a lengthy letter in response to the French premier, which was made public. And he wrote, again, he doesn't cite Gliwice or the border incident or anything like that as the reason for the tension between the two countries. He writes this: "I understand the qualms you possess. I, too, have never overlooked the high responsibility which rests on those who are in a position to decide the fate of nations. As an old frontline soldier, I have the same feeling about the horrors of war as you do. It is from this conviction and knowledge that I have made honest efforts to eliminate all the grounds of conflict between the two nations, that is, between Poland and Germany." Being both old frontline soldiers, perhaps we understand each other more easily on many points, he writes to the French premier. "However, I must ask you to understand this too, that it is impossible for a nation with a sense of honor to waive their claim to almost 2 million people and see them maltreated on their own frontier. I have therefore formulated a clear-cut demand. Danzig and the corridor must revert to Germany. The Macedonian conditions, that is, the conditions of chaos and disorder on our eastern frontier, must disappear. I can see no other way of inducing Poland, which now believes itself unassailable under the protection of the guarantees, that is, from Britain, to take steps toward a peaceable solution. Should fate thereby once more force our two peoples," in this case he means France and Germany, "to fight, there will yet be a difference in our motives. I and my people will be fighting to right, and the others to maintain a wrong which has been inflicted on us. I am quite aware of the dire consequences which would result from such a conflict, but I believe that Poland would suffer most, for whichever way the war about this question went, the present Polish state would be lost anyhow. Not only for you, Monsieur Daladier, but for me too. It is most painful that our two peoples are now to embark on a new bloody war of extermination on these grounds. But as I said before, I cannot see a way for us to induce Poland by rational means to correct a situation which is intolerable for the German people and the German Reich." Now again, Hitler laid out in this letter to the French premier, and in similar letters, and in public statements, the great grievance that Germany had at this time. And this was the foundation and the basis for the German attack against Poland, because all other means, as Hitler saw it, had been exhausted. But he didn't cite this so-called pretext of a Polish attack against a German radio station as the or even a reason or pretext for the war. Now, as I said, I have been unable to find any playing up of this so-called pretext in the German media as an excuse for war. And it's noteworthy that although it's claimed to be the pretext, you'll find this in American books and so forth, I've never seen, for example, even a single photograph or any specific thing other than claims made at Nuremberg to show that this was any kind of pretext or public pretext for going to war by Germany against Poland. But more importantly is the question of why is it that Britain and France declared war against Germany at that time? Because, and this is a very important point, a German attack against Poland is not a world war. It's an attack by one country against another over very specific, limited issues. Germany and France could have stayed out of the conflict and made sure that the conflict did not become a larger one. Indeed, a good argument could be made that if Britain and France had simply stayed out of war in 1939, eventually Germany and the Soviet Union would have gone to war against each other, and that would have been a conflict between two countries and Britain, other than Britain and France, and they could have simply stayed out of it. But Britain and France decided to make this a reason to go to war against Germany. Why is that? What was behind this? Well, a very important aspect of this, and I've dealt with this on other occasions, was the tremendous pressure being put on Britain and France, and especially Britain, by the United States at this time. This was also exacerbated and played up by a tremendous press campaign at the time against Germany in British newspapers, in the British media, and in the American media, portraying Hitler as intent on going to war with everybody, with the whole, ultimately determined to take over the world. This is borne out and confirmed by secret dispatches written by Polish ambassadors in Washington and London and Paris, which confirm the pressure by the United States on Britain and France to go to war against Germany over the Danzig and Polish issue. In 1938, the Polish ambassador in Washington, Count Jerzy Potocki, in February 1938, wrote to the foreign minister in Warsaw, and I'm quoting, "The pressure of the Jews on President Roosevelt on the State Department is becoming ever more powerful." Again, this is more than a year and a half before the outbreak of war in 1939. "The Jews are right now the leaders in creating a war psychosis which would plunge the entire world into war and bring about general catastrophe. This mood is becoming more and more apparent. In their definition of democratic states, the Jews have also created real chaos. They have mixed together the idea of democracy and communism, and have above all raised the banner of burning hatred against Nazism. This hatred has become a frenzy. It is propagated everywhere and by every means, in theaters, in the cinema, and in the press. The Germans are portrayed as a nation living under the arrogance of Hitler, which wants to conquer the whole world and drown all of humanity in an ocean of blood. In conversations with Jewish press representatives, I have repeatedly come up against the inexorable and convinced view that war is inevitable. This international Jewry exploits every means of propaganda to oppose any tendency toward any kind of consolidation and understanding between nations. In this way, the conviction is growing steadily but surely in public opinion here, that is in the U.S., that the Germans and their satellites in the form of fascism are enemies who must be subdued by the democratic world," quote unquote. Well, again, it's important to remember that it was the Allies who used the German attack against Poland as a pretext for war against Germany. The insincerity and deceit of the British declarations of war, based supposedly on concern for Poland, is proven by the fact that 3 weeks after Germany attacked, the Soviet Union attacked Poland from the east, and Britain and France did not declare war against the Soviet Union. If concern for Polish independence was really an issue and really the reason why Poland and France declared war against Germany in 1939, or why America, the American press, which claimed to be so concerned about Polish independence, if that had really been sincere, then Britain and France should have declared war against the Soviet Union. But they didn't. They declared war only against Germany. Again, this was enormously fortified, bolstered by assurances given by American diplomats to Britain and France of American support if they declared war. Finally, the claim that by Britain and France that they had to stop a powerful Germany from subduing Poland was a lie and a pretext, because at the end of six terrible years of horrible war, Poland, at the end, was not independent. It was entirely under the control of the Soviet Union, and the Soviets imposed their own regime, their own hegemony on Poland in a brutal takeover that has received very little of the attention it should in our history books and in our media. But more than that, in January 1939, the Polish ambassador reported from Washington to the Polish Foreign Ministry that the American public is subject to an ever more alarming propaganda which is under Jewish influence and continuously conjures up the specter of the danger of war. Because of this, the Americans have strongly altered their views on foreign policy problems in comparison with last year. In a secret conversation at Hyde Park on May 28, 1939, again, months before war had even broken out, Roosevelt assured the former president of Czechoslovakia, Dr. Edvard Beneš, that America would actively intervene on the side of Britain and France in the anticipated European war. Many years after the war, Georges Bonnet, the French foreign minister, in 1939 confirmed the crucial role of Bullitt, the American ambassador in Paris, as Roosevelt's deputy in pushing his country, France, into war. In a letter to Hamilton Fish, an American congressman, Bonnet wrote, "One thing is certain is that Bullitt, William Bullitt, in 1939 did everything he could to make France enter the war." And in a crucial confirmation of the role of Roosevelt and Jews in pushing Britain into war came from the diary of James Forrestal, the first U.S. Secretary of Defense. He noted in his diary in December 1945 about a conversation with former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Kennedy, father of the president, who was ambassador in London in 1939. And he said that Kennedy confirmed to him that Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, said that America and the world Jews had forced England into the war, and that the war was unquestionably avoidable if the policy pursued by Britain and France and by Poland, and of course by Germany too, had been more realistic. Hitler obviously made a great mistake, because he did not calculate or believe that Britain and France would respond to the German attack against Poland by declaring war against Germany. He believed that such a French and British declaration of war would be irrational, because it would not succeed in actually securing and defending. They were not in no position to really help Poland anyway. And that's been shown by events. All the same, Hitler miscalculated, but so did Britain and France, and so did the Poles. Often in history, that's what happened. That's what's happened. But it shows that the British and French declarations of war, if they had not been made, would have kept the war confined to Germany and Poland in 1939, and ultimately, perhaps, a war later between the Soviet Union and Germany, but not the World War II that we all today know. Well, that concludes this broadcast, and I hope you'll join me for the next Mark Weber Report.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.